Welcome back to Alternative Realities, a podcast about the people, strategies, and stories driving the world of alternative investments. I'm Aaron Mulvihill, Global Market Strategist here at JP Morgan Asset Management. Commercial real estate has undergone one of the most dramatic shifts in decades. The pandemic upended demand for office space, accelerated the impact of e-commerce, impact on retail, and created both turmoil and opportunity across the market. But commercial real estate, of course, isn't one market. It's a mosaic of asset types, geographies, and risk profiles. On this episode, I'm joined by Thomas Kennedy, Head of Research and Investment Strategy for Real Estate Americas at JP Morgan Asset Management. Tom was previously the Chief Investment Strategist for JP Morgan Private Bank, advising high net worth clients. Prior to that, he held various research and policy positions at the Federal Reserve Bank of New York. I really enjoyed our conversation, and I think you will too. So let's get started. And by the way, if you're listening to the audio version of this podcast, you can now watch along on YouTube by tuning in to our JP Morgan Asset Management channel, linked in the show notes. Tom, welcome to Alternative Realities.
Thanks for having me, Aaron. Great to be here.
So real estate is an area very close to my heart. My father is actually a carpenter, so I grew up in that world. I'd love to hear a little bit about your background. What brought you to your role here today?
Yeah, I love that about real estate. It's relatable to everybody, right? Either you own a home or maybe someone in your family was in the business. I consider myself a recovering central banker turned investor. I spent really the early part of my career, almost 10 years at the New York Fed. My most formative time there was working for Simon Potter and Lori Logan. They were the portfolio managers for the New York Fed.
Okay.
And they taught me how to take data to create evidence about what's happening in the world and use it to make a decision. So I really researched and wrote a speech that started every FOMC. I did that for about 4 years. I do think it was really the most seminal piece of my life that taught me how to do what we do today. I joined JP Morgan about 7 years ago, and I was most recently the chief investment strategist in wealth management. So kind of took that data-based approach to stack evidence and make an investment recommendation.
Yeah.
And recently moved into the real estate business here in asset management. And I think that's been a pretty big journey, but it shows one of the many luxuries of working in a place like JP Morgan. We get moved around to learn new skills and grow with this great business.
Yeah, it's a big space. There's a lot of areas, certainly a lot of areas you could move into coming from somewhere like the New York Fed. So if you kind of put your Fed hat back on and as Fed Tom, how do you feel about interest rates right now in terms of real estate? What does higher for longer mean?
Yeah, I do think this concept of higher for longer is real. I think it's here. Mostly for two reasons. First is COVID showed us that inflation is possible. There's great academic research that talks about inflation, and if inflation expectations are high enough or at a specific level, the consumer will allow those prices to come to them. At the moment, inflation expectations, as we look at out 5 years or even 10 years, are well above 2%. Right. So above the Fed's 2% mandate. So
we got very used to 2% for a long time.
Yeah, and the Fed, during my time when I was with them, they had to fight, keep rates really low to push inflation expectations up. Now we don't have that situation, and really COVID induced that. The other side of that is that the second point is for the most of my career at the Fed, again, you had low interest rates because of inflation expectations being low and globalization. So the willingness of a corporation to take the cheapest input from anywhere on the planet, no matter what, I think rising geopolitical risk is changing that. And for America, I think it's most acute with China, where China dominates very specific parts of the supply chain around semiconductors and batteries and processors.
Consumer goods.
Yeah, so the notion that we might break away from China a little bit, well, if globalization was good at pushing inflation down and interest rates down, I think the opposite is true. So I think as you look forward, the notion that we would go back to the zero low bound very low and that this higher for longer environment that we're in right now is likely to endure.
Yeah. Yeah. Is that a good thing for real estate? How do you look at that? I know it wasn't a good thing when we were seeing high inflation and interest rates rose in 2022. That was challenging. How are you feeling about that going forward?
Yeah, you and I wrote a good blog post on this a couple of weeks ago.
I think so too.
We wouldn't, right? Put it out if we didn't think. But I think it's in three steps, right? We talked about it in three steps for higher for longer and commercial real estate. Phase one is where we have to take this long duration asset and change the discount model, right? The way we make money in real estate is we buy the asset today and we get an income stream off of it. Well, if interest rates come up, we have to discount those cash flows back at a higher rate. They become less valuable. So what we saw after a once in 40-year hiking cycle from the Fed was 20 to 25% on average decline in the valuation of commercial real estate.
Right.
So that's phase one. I think that phase is really done. It was really 2023 and parts of 2024 where that happened. In some parts of the market, you're actually seeing prices come up now and increase.
Yeah. Yeah.
But that behests kind of stage two, which is high interest rates now make it uneconomical to want to create new supply. And we're seeing that across every sector of the real estate market. From the peak starts post-COVID, new starts are down 75%, give or take.
Mm.
And that may not, well, who really cares? Well, the economy keeps moving, right? We have wage growth that's happening. Yeah. The demand side looks healthy.
Yeah.
Wages are picking up, or wages are continuing to grow. New housing formation happens, right? People have kids or people want to move. And the industrial sector is changing because of that separation from China. So supply down, demand staying constant, is a nice outlook as we look out to 26, 27. And then finally, step three is like, what do we do? Like, as investors, what's the advice we give? Well, in a higher for longer environment, the best quality assets are most likely to win. And I think we're seeing seeds of that, but that's, I think, is going to define 2026.
Yeah. So as demand catches up, it's really difficult right now for developers to actually take the risk, build real estate, add new supply, and we're seeing these starting to meet up.
Yeah, I think there's a couple of other things happening in there too, Aaron. Like the supply picture as we look forward is very suppressed, but demand is constant. I think we're talking about interest rates, but there's other things happening why the cost to build something is going up. Immigration into America, the policies are keeping new entrants to the market that might help in construction quite low.
Yeah.
And tariffs also putting an impulse into some of those inputs to build. So a lot of these new projects just don't quite pencil, if you will. They just don't make a lot of economic sense right now. What we'll need to see is demand, to your point, keep coming through.
Yeah. Yeah. Which from where we're standing, we do see economic growth. We're not in, if we go back a few months ago, we were talking about potential recession. That's right off the table. So that growth may be starting to meet a challenging supply scenario. So when it comes to investment, how do you look at commercial real estate right now as an investment?
I think this is a great opportunity. And I don't think I'm stretching too far to say a once in a generation time to want to invest in real estate. Again, those three phases, I think we're firmly in phase two, where the outlook for new supply is so low that owners of assets in a year, 2 years' time are going to have a lot of capacity to increase rents. But you can also look to history for this one, Aaron, where you say in the last 50 years, commercial real estate prices have only had, this will be the third double-digit or more decline in valuations. It's very rare. And in each time, those prior two times, you started at least a decade-long recovery.
Yeah.
So a different way to change the discussion is, oh, yes, higher for longer is a problem. But no, you're also buying great assets at a 20, 25% discount. And with the lack of supply that's going to come, that asset should accrue more value as you move forward.
Right. But being selective with what assets you're targeting.
Yeah, I think this is critical. The quality matters point cannot be overstated.
Yeah.
Because in a very low interest rate environment, statistically, when we were at the zero lower bound, you didn't see much differentiation between a piece of commercial real estate that had low income growth or low rent growth versus one that had high rent growth. I hope you say, that's crazy. Like, why wouldn't there be a differentiation? Well, you just had to buy assets and add leverage to them.
Right. Leverage is a huge component.
That was it. It was just you had to get the leverage right. And now with interest rates being high, that's not a tool you can really use to drive total return. I think you need quality to get there. And it's kind of this mantra we have of like the things that drove performance in the last 5 years for real estate, very unlikely to be the things that drive returns in the next 5 years.
Right. When we think about economic growth, foundation of economic growth in the U.S. is always the consumer.
Yeah.
Where does a consumer play into commercial real estate?
I think it's why a lot of Fed people or macroeconomists are very attracted to real estate. So in a statistical model of owning commercial real estate, over half of your total return is driven by the labor market and the consumer.
Right.
So just in a variable sense, this is the most important thing to get right. And I think it's a unique piece of working at JP Morgan where we have the best data on the planet. JP Morgan, in more than 50% of American households, there's at least one JP Morgan or Chase product. It allows people like us to look at this data and dissect the trends that are happening there. And inside the labor market, what do we see? I mean, at the moment, wage growth, like more income growth, like are people getting jobs? And if so, how much are the wages going up? Income growth is growing on average about 4.5%. That is more or less the average we saw pre-COVID. So we've kind of normalized in that labor market. Remember, post-COVID, we were seeing income growth 15%.
Oh, yeah.
So we've normalized a lot. The job market is like propensity for new jobs on an unemployment rate of 4.1% is pretty good. And then lastly is like the consumer is so much more than just their income. You have to look at their balance sheet. We know the stock market's at an all-time high, and about 2/3 of Americans own their home. And this is a fun one for people like us. We don't get to say this very often. Never in the history of the data have Americans had this much equity in their home. What does that mean? Let's say the home price is worth $1 million. The average American has about $750,000 in equity and only $250,000 in debt. Compared to the global financial crisis, there were parts of that cycle where there was more debt than there was equity in the average home price. So all it means is that the income and labor market side may have normalized, but the income is only one piece of their willingness to take maybe higher rents in commercial real estate.
Yeah, and it's sort of cyclical, right? Self-perpetuating, as you say, the wealth effect.
Yes.
Right? People feel good about themselves. They feel wealthy because their home is appreciated so much. And that actually contributes to growing the economy.
And there is, this financial conditions or wealth effect that you're describing is very pronounced for folks that own their home, right?
Yeah.
Again, 2/3 of Americans own their home.
Yeah, we have to get back to the 1/3.
That's
where
right.
It's really challenging right now.
It's haves and have-nots for sure. And the way that kind of perpetuates through our real estate portfolio is we really target multifamily rental properties or single-family rentals, what we would call attainable housing.
Okay.
These are folks that maybe want to own their first home but can't quite afford it yet. Affordability is a big problem. And what we see in our portfolio is attainable rents versus, say, a luxury rental, maybe right here in New York City, we can push attainable rents higher annually by maybe 1 to 3 percentage points more than what we see in comparable luxury apartments.
Okay.
And why is that relevant? Like, it's because it's latching on to this affordability challenge of people that want the American dream. But nonetheless, it's like trying to stay with that cohort of folks that own a home and own financial assets where financial conditions really matter.
Right. So people that otherwise would own a home today are renting because it's become so challenging to actually afford a mortgage. I think I heard some stats on like the average home ownership or the average age today that somebody's buying a home.
Yeah.
56 is the average. And the average first time home buyer is 38.
Yeah, that one always staggering to me. The median first time home buyer in 2024 was 38 years old. And 10 years ago, that was when I bought my first house, the median first-time home buyer was 30 years old.
Right.
So it's been almost 10 years and people being priced out of that market. I'm looking here for this stat exactly because I do not want to mess it up. When you look to this American dream, this new single-family rental market has been growing for maybe 5 to 10 years. What is that? Someone that wants to own their home but can't quite afford it yet.
Yeah.
Well, at the moment, the cost to own a 3-bedroom house is 50% more than renting a 3-bedroom house on average in America. This is the biggest spread we've ever seen in the history of the data. Not that much data. But this shows you how challenged affordability is, but also should show you we expect to be able to push rents. And that's how the total returns for at least single family rental, we think, will work over the next 3 to 5 years.
Right. That's a fascinating dynamic. So if you look at, real estate, it's location, location, location.
Yep.
Where are you looking geographically around the United States, single family, multifamily? What's appealing to you right now?
Yeah, in the multifamily and single family rental market, if we look backwards, all you had to do was buy in the Sun Belt, and that's where migration patterns would happen, and that was all you really needed to do in multifamily.
Yeah, I came to the U.S. 6 years ago, lived in Atlanta first for 2 years, and I was firsthand witness to this, just the enormous growth that was had. I did not buy a home in Atlanta, unfortunately, or yeah. I'd be in a much better position financially than I am now. But
there are parts that naturally see apartment rent growth and apartment supply growth. So trying to pull two dynamics together, everything for real estate, supply and demand. So the demand construct post-COVID was moving from big blue coastal cities inland, maybe that be to the south, as you're mentioning, mm-hmm. or into the Sun Belt or towards Texas, those types of things.
Yeah.
But what followed that migration was a big surge in supply and building. The vast majority of multifamily is built in those regions. But we've kind of normalized. And in fact, actually, you're seeing rent growth in those markets lower than what you're seeing in the New York area or in parts of the Midwest. And like what worked in those last 5 years is unlikely to be the thing that works in the next 5 years. This is another example. Investors have shunned the Midwest for multifamily for over a decade. It's been an underperformer. It's not particularly institutionalized. But we're starting to see in specific cities there the setup for a very good outlook for investing. Initial yield, so how much you buy the property for versus the income rate, highest out of any region in America. Supply, very low. And migration patterns into some of these cities like Columbus or Indianapolis, actually quite healthy. And business formation in those places, likely to lure higher quality talent. This is the setup you look for. Now, in the real estate market, people have been shunning this market for a long time. But things are changing, and this is a growth opportunity set that we see.
Yeah, and is that driven by COVID and migration patterns, or have we just ignored this part of the country in favor of the Sun Belt for some years?
I think it's part of all of those things, but ultimately, we see this in our Chase data too. Why do people move from New York to Austin, Texas? Like, why did they do that? I think we've made this narrative of they do it because it's sunnier, it's nicer. But really, if you create an affordability construct of, well, how much is their wage going to be versus their cost of living there?
Yeah.
People almost exclusively move where it's more affordable. And at the moment, the Midwest is screening as quite affordable compared to these other markets. So it's the migration patterns, it's the job formation, it's affordability, and it just moves and changes over time. I think some folks are still stuck on the Sun Belt, and I'm not suggesting that that's going to be a major underperformer, but I think there's an opportunity to diversify out of there and still see good, solid total returns.
Right. So looking at another sector now, the industrial sector.
Yeah.
Right. Whether it's warehousing, factories, a lot of talk about onshoring.
Yeah.
How do you feel about industrial right now? And you know, is this onshoring effect real? Is it something we're going to see this year or it's not going to take place for a while?
The onshoring effect is very real, but it's nuanced. We're not seeing evidence that any manufacturing is coming back. But what is being onshored is companies that demand high power capacity buildings. So for your imagination, use a robotics company or an aerospace and defense company. But let's set the stage. You were in infrastructure business for a long time.
Right.
For the last 20 years, America has grown the warehouse and distribution square footage of the industrial sector of America by about 5 billion square feet. And think of that as importing goods, put it in a big Amazon box, and then trucks pick it up and deliver it.
5 billion square feet.
5 billion. And the manufacturing piece of the industrial sector has seen square footage growth of about 250 million square feet. So the order of magnitude is, I mean, there's basically been no growth in the manufacturing sector in 20 years.
I'm surprised to some extent that it actually has grown because we hear about decline more than we hear about growth.
Yeah, I think that's true. I mean, so the point there is the magnitude of 5 billion versus 250 million. You're probably right that 250 will surprise some folks. The point is now we're at an inflection point where in the last 5 years since COVID, demand for manufacturing space has grown at a 50% growth rate per year.
Mm.
So all of a sudden, this surge of interest in manufacturing space, I think it's onshoring, but it's the specific types of companies. So in our portfolio, you got to think of business, the manufacturing space as how much power capacity does it have, which is not a variable, Aaron. And you correct me if I'm wrong. In your career, did you really think about that spec? It was all what you said, proximity. Where am I to people?
Yeah.
Where am I to the talent pool? Well, there's a new P in this, proximity and power. And in our portfolio, last 12 months, if our buildings that have 4,000 amps or more, 10% total return or more, 2,000 amps or less, 2 to 3% total returns. There is a new tenant. They need this power. There's not enough supply of these types of buildings, and they're going to have to pay up rent to get there. And that's what that growth rate is.
It's a really important nuance, because we talk a lot about economic growth and onshoring, but like exactly what type of manufacturing is this going to be? This isn't necessarily a large building full of manual laborers assembling or sewing T-shirts. It's automated, industrialized, high technology manufacturing. That's what we might see coming onshore.
And the Taiwan semiconductor plant that's being built in Arizona is really a great way to expose how that commercial real estate market will change.
Mm.
And there's academic literature about this, about the Taiwan Semi effect. But Taiwan Semi is investing something like $250 billion. The number changes all the time in and around that plant. But what else is it going to lure? High quality talent. So migration changes. That's high quality migration of jobs that pay a high wage.
Mm.
And it's the same drivers for real estate. You're going to need multifamily units there. You're going to need retail there. You're going to need to further develop that economy. And the academic in me says, what's the economic multiplier of that type of investment? And it's historically the highest you're going to get in an economy. So for each dollar that goes in there, you might get $4 of growth, $5 of growth. We're trying to latch on to this really big change in the industrial sector, but also what it might mean for other sectors of the real estate market.
Right. And so you're looking for buildings that have that power supply, that can power automated manufacturing. And yeah, I think certainly from my experience around manufacturing plants for a number of years, one interesting nuance there, I think, is that older buildings, often they may have the power on paper, but do they have clean power that you can actually run like highly automated facilities with?
Yeah.
They may have something that's built in the 1970s that has older switch gears. They have older kind of equipment inside. The wiring's maybe not up to scratch.
Yeah.
That's not going to work when you're putting in, semiconductor manufacturing. You're putting in, something that's really robotic or requires, fully 24/7 clean power. So
it's one of the many things I love about talking with you. It's the thing I don't have your experience, but on paper, a building can look really valuable. But with that type of expertise, just because the power, it's going to need certain kind of networking and switches. Interesting.
Yeah, yeah. You open up the boxes and the walls, and it may be a different story. But so they're the kind of building, and you're doing the due diligence, obviously, on these buildings and looking at the ones that have that capability to support advanced manufacturing. So a couple of rapid fire questions, maybe just as we're coming up on time here. We get a lot of these questions from clients around office. How do you feel about the office sector right now or going forward?
I think office has turned. The return to work dynamics is emblematic of that. But this is a place where quality really matters.
Mm.
At the moment, about 10% of all office buildings in America account for 60% of vacancy. So concentrated vacancy. About 40% of office buildings in America have no vacancy. So what type of asset would you want to own? We want to own high quality office and really trophy office offices. And quality matters more than anything in this sector, even if the sector has turned.
Okay. Debt versus equity. How do you look at investing across the debt versus equity spectrum in real estate?
It's a unique time, right? Over the last 12 months, total returns in the debt of real estate, if you're an investor. Mm. So if I gave a loan to someone who wants to buy a building, have been higher than what the equity in a commercial real estate building has returned.
Okay.
This is inverted. It's not normal. in our JP, in one of our products, we have a REIT product where there is actually debt showing up in an equity product. So this is a very unique time. As we look forward, though, we should expect some rate cuts from the Fed, right? The market's pricing about 100 basis points of rate cuts over the next 12 months.
Right.
So debt yields should come down. And as we talked about for most of this session is equity side is going to return. So I think there's going to be a normalization as you look forward. Mm. But at the moment, you can own both and probably diversify yourself to own both.
Yeah. Last question. Retail.
Yeah.
I'm surprised by this. The retail sector has been the best performing sector over the last 12 months. Why?
You haven't been able to say that for almost a decade, that retail is the best performer. Retail is outperforming because supply has been almost non-existent for many years. And the types of assets now are these high quality assets. We focus mostly on grocery anchored strip centers.
Mm.
So this is you and I driving in the suburbs to go pick up some groceries and maybe stopping at a bagel store or to get your haircut, something like that.
Local businesses.
Yeah. And why do we like that? That these are necessity based items that people still want to go to the store and buy groceries there.
Mm.
And then what we're also seeing is foot traffic in trophy malls is actually picking up. So this notion that like online ordering and online shopping is going to kill all types of commerce is just really not true. So I think the real reason why retail's performed so well is the supply. There is no supply. You haven't seen a real high quality mall built in a long time. But also that some of the things we thought would be true of e-commerce will kill everything, it's just not true. They can coexist.
The pendulum is swinging back a little bit.
Yeah, I think so. I think, again, though, quality matters. You have to own the best quality strip centers with loyalty from a grocery anchor tenant and malls that are high luxury. They cater to those folks that have maybe own a home or own financial assets, more luxury type of settings there.
Right. Tom, this has been great. Thank you very much for joining us on Alternative Realities.
Oh, thanks for having me, Aaron.
To all our viewers and listeners, thank you very much for listening to the Alternative Realities podcast. You can download our quarterly guide to alternatives on the JP Morgan Asset Management website at jpmorgan.com/GTA. And if you've not already done so, please subscribe to the podcast.
This material is for information purposes only. The views, opinions, and statements of financial market trends that are based on current market conditions are those of the speaker and may differ from those expressed by JP Morgan Asset Management or by other areas of JP Morgan Chase & Company. Any companies referenced are shown for illustrative purposes only and are not intended as a recommendation. We believe the information provided here is reliable, but should not be assumed to be accurate or complete. The views and strategies described may not be suitable for all investors. This content is intended for information only based on assumptions and current market conditions and are subject to change. No warranty of accuracy is given. This content does not contain sufficient information to support investment decisions. It is not to be construed as research, legal, regulatory, tax, accounting, or investment advice. Investments involve risks. Investors should seek professional advice or make an independent evaluation before investing. The value of investments and the income from them may fluctuate, including loss of capital. Past performance and yield are not indicative of current or future results. Forecasts and estimates may or may not come to pass. JP Morgan Asset Management is the asset management business of JP Morgan Chase & Company and its affiliates worldwide.